Audi.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francescanand. Today's guest has had a glittering career so far as one of the UK's best car journalists. I asked how he would like to be introduced on the podcast and he suggested a pound shop Jeremy Clarkson. Of course, one could argue that Jeremy Clarkson is a pound shop Jeremy Clarkson. And I would like to think that the lovely Ben Oliver is far more than that. He's a motoring journalist who specialises in taking cars to very distant places where he says they probably shouldn't really go. He writes stunning articles about such journeys for newspapers and magazines around the world, and amongst other things is contributing editor of Car Magazine. Let's give him a proper introduction. Motoring journalist Ben Oliver was born amid the Troubles in Belfast, with the family moving to slightly dull Reading when he was six. We talk about his life-changing teen travels to Israel, Tunisia, Gaza and Kurdistan, the glory 90s and noughties days of magazine journalism, how LA porn sets are like clinical operating rooms, driving an open-top Bentley up the Blood Highway to the Arctic Circle in winter, the road sliding away in the monsoon on an insane Himalayas trip in a mini, North Korea being one of the most bizarre travel experiences, the joys of EVs and much more.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So talk to me.
Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow.
Is that your go-to?
My mum was a radio journalist.
And
that's what she always, that was her kind of go-to. So she whenever she was testing levels, that's what she went to. She probably picked it up from some other, you know, radio journalist from years ago. So what? She was a film critic, and that's how we ended up with that business in the film industry, basically. So I kind of took it over from her, expanded it slightly, largely.
Is that why you went into journalism?
No, I don't know. My dad was a reporter as well, but a hard news reporter, and was a war correspondent, and a foreign correspondent, and the chief reporter on the Daily Mirror. And it was a bit like, I mean, you sort of liken it to being the village blacksmith's son. Like, if you grow up around that, then I think that's kind of what you end up sort of doing almost by default. So, and also it kind of influenced my attitude to travel, I suppose. I just saw him traveling the world for work, and I don't know, subconsciously just sort of, you know, absorbed the fact that you could do that. You know, you could make a living out of traveling and going overseas and seeing all these different places. We ended up in different, very different forms of journalism. Obviously, he was a hard news reporter, and I've always been a feature writer, but yeah, I suppose fundamentally that was a guiding influence, I suppose, in the very early years. I'd literally find out where he was based on what was on the front page of the Daily Mirror that day. You know, he'd sort of come back from school, you know, the paper would have been delivered, and he'd be, you know, there for the end of communism in Russia, you know, the disintegration of the Warsaw Pact, the first Gulf War, much earlier in the Falklands War. And so, yeah, that was ingrained, I suppose, from quite an early age.
Did you see him a lot, or was he always travelling?
Not a huge amount, actually. Like, he was quite distant, I suppose, as a dad. He wasn't there physically, obviously, a lot of the time. So, like, a very admirable character, you know, like, compared to the other dads at school who were, you know, accountants or IT guys. No disrespect to, you know, accountants or IT guys. He was on the front page of the papers, you know, yeah. And he was there, whatever the biggest stories were, you know, from kind of the, I suppose, from kind of the Falklands War onwards. That would have been my kind of my earliest memories of him going away. There was an excitement to that, you know, and he you know, I remember him coming in to do a talk in my school where he sort of came in his body armor that he had been wearing in whatever the current war was, basically, you know, the Gulf War and Kosovo or whatever, and that was hugely exciting. That was something to kind of look up to. But he was kind of a dad that you sort of admired and were excited by, rather than kind of a touchy-feely dad who was sort of there for, you know, every, you know, cycle race I was in or whatever. So
proper old school journalism, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it really was, and it's kind of sad the extent to which I think that's declined. You know, the newspapers just don't have the budgets now to send reporters off to the wars, you know, or do any kind of sort of serious reporting the way we did back then. I think we've really lost something with that. You know, I think the whole, you know, Leveson inquiry and all the rest of it had to happen, you know, but I think we might sort of regret sort of neutering the press to quite the same extent that we have done. And also newspapers just don't have the budget. You know, they're not getting the advertising revenue. Clearly our attention has gone, you know, sort of totally online, and so having big, well-staffed newsrooms is really a thing of the past, you know. And so as a result, I think a lot of stuff goes unreported. You know, there are all sorts of stories that previously would have been picked up on by newspapers, national and local and regional newspapers as well, that we just don't see. You know, investigations just don't happen anymore. When you actually read stories, even in, you know, great newspapers, not so much the Financial Times, but certainly, you know, the Times and the Guardian and the Telegraph, a lot of the time the reporters are just re-reporting what's already happened on social media. Nobody actually speaks to anybody anymore, you know, whereas in the past the reporters had absolutely direct off-the-record connections with politicians and policemen and criminals and businessmen and all the rest of it, and that's where stories came from. And that era of journalism, yeah, my father was very much a part of, and sadly it's gone. And I think initially I sort of felt like I wanted to go down a similar route, I suppose, and be a hard news reporter. And I did, in the early years at university, do some work, not so much with my father, but with other kind of tabloid reporters. Did some work with the fake sheikh, Maz Mahmood, and did a few sort of slightly sleazy sex scandals, which I immediately regretted and thought
you were involved in.
I brought the stories in, basically, right, okay, and reported them and sort of got those scoops, and pretty quickly realised that wasn't the kind of writing that I wanted to do, and that, you know, sort of feature writing was definitely where it was at. And that still gave you that same flexibility and that freedom to travel. The difference was you could just choose where you wanted to go, you know, and so, you know, if there was a part of the world that I wanted to go to or an event that I wanted to see or whatever, I could generally, as a magazine writer, invent an excuse to go there. Mm. You know, you go and you sell out as a story to an editor, and so yeah, that's been the basis of what passes for a career ever since.
So where were you growing up? Because you've got an accent, haven't you? What is that accent?
It's a residual Northern Irish accent.
A
lot of people guess Antipodean, you know, like Australian or Kiwi, but for, yeah, whatever reason, yeah, whatever slight twinge of Belfast remains in my voice comes across as Aussie.
The Belfast, so, that's really interesting.
No, my family are all from Belfast, a few from Dublin, but then when my father was we were given a job on the Daily Mail first, and then the Mirror, we left Belfast and moved to the lovely Reading in Berkshire.
So you were growing up in Belfast during the Troubles?
Well, I lived there until I was six. And then from six until I was 18, when I went off travelling, then I was in the spectacularly dull, frankly, Reading, which is quite the contrast, obviously,
yeah, exactly,
to, you know, sort of Belfast in the 70s or early 80s by comparison with Reading. I mean, honestly, you couldn't get two towns within the UK that were more different.
Boring is probably better than a war zone. I mean,
definitely.
What was it like in Belfast? Do you remember anything?
I don't remember a huge amount about the Troubles before I left, but I certainly remember going back, which obviously we did pretty frequently from the age of, you know, sort of six onwards. I remember, armed personnel carriers on the street, you know, sort of the armoured IEC vehicles, you know, the security checkpoints that were all the way down, you know, sort of Donegal Avenue, the main sort of shopping street in Belfast. And I also remember those things getting better as well, you know, and the place feeling like less militarised and less like a police state. You know, when we were going back every, you know, sort of 6 months or so, you would see the changes. So, and now the place has transformed. I mean, it's just extraordinary. You've got the whole Game of Thrones coast on like the North Antrim coast. Belfast city centre in terms of bars and restaurants is just amazing. There's such a great kind of foodie culture there now, you know. And of course those tensions haven't entirely gone away, and they do sort of rear their heads again, but honestly one of the great joys of my life for seeing the transformation in that place. And, you know, I go back there a lot now, obviously, because I've got family there, and I do a big road trip back there with my two kids every year. And clearly it's a place that you can travel to without a qualm. And you can do the whole sort of troubles tourism thing.
Yes,
if you want to, you can jump in a black cab, you know, with a former paramilitary who'll drive you around and, you know, show you the murals and show you where, you know, some of the worst atrocities took place. But like a lot of people just don't bother with that. They just want to enjoy it as a city, the same way you'd have a, you know, a weekend break in Edinburgh or Glasgow or wherever. So yeah, things are massively better.
So you went travelling at 18?
Yeah, and you're the travel expert. Do people, do kids still do this? I had, you know, it was honestly one of the most formative experiences of my life. You know, I had from between the age of 6 and 18. I've been a bit rude about Reading. Okay, let me take that back. You know, it was a fine place to grow up.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
I mean, I go there on my holidays all the time. It's a great high street.
Yeah, but I think I was aware, particularly with Dad's job as well, that Reading was not the most exciting place in the world, and it would be nice to go and see a bit of the world before I travelled. So I had that, I know it's a massive cliche, but I had that gap year.
Yeah.
And, but I, you know, I was at a comprehensive school. I saved up the money kind of working for the first 6 months of that year to then travel for 9 months. Before I went to university, and it was genuinely the most transformative experience of my, my life. I was living in Israel, but I was working with Palestinian students teaching English. I sort of travelled around, went down through Egypt, down to the Sudanese border, came back up sort of through the Gaza Strip, ended up in Syria, in Kurdistan, spent a couple of months actually in Istanbul, set up another little school there for refugees, and genuinely came back feeling like a different person. But I watched The Serpent recently,
where
clearly, without giving too much away, backpackers are at risk from this guy. And I sort of looked back and I thought, oh my God, how did my parents let me go, this sort of callow youth at the age of 18 with no life experience, to Syria of all places, you know, or Israel in the middle of the Intifada, you know.
But you've just rattled off a whole load of countries that people also didn't go to. You know,
no,
people
true.
Did the Thailand, you know, Australia, a bit of fruit picking. You've gone to slightly unusual
countries. Yeah, I think I was pretty clear that I just didn't want to do the standard, you know, go and do a ski season or, you know, sort of travel around Australia, whatever. And those are fine, of course, and those are great experiences. But I had a real sort of fascination with the Middle East in particular. And also those places at the time, you know, Westerners weren't going to Syria. You know, Syria, I think, had only recently come off the US State Department's list of states sponsoring terrorism. And so there really was no tourism at all. And you know, we, at the age of 18, I was traveling with a mate, same age. We got to the central bus station in Damascus, and we had a little bit of Arabic at that stage. And we were told that the place to stay was the Hotel Pakistan, right? Because apparently that was the cheapest place in town. And we got chatting with a guy who had, I think, worked in the US and had a bit of English. And we explained who we were and what we were doing in Damascus. And he just said, if you've bothered to come and visit my city, there is no way you're staying in a hotel. And so he invited us back to stay in a flat with him and his family, you know, and it was extraordinary. And these people didn't have much, but whatever they had, they shared. And those kind of experiences were invaluable. But I kind of wondered, do kids still do that?
You know, I don't know.
In this age of like constant communications, are parents prepared to let the kids go and do that sort of stuff anymore?
I don't think
do you
they
hear
do.
About it?
No, or? That's a really good question. As the travel expert, but also a mum, but my kids are younger, as yours are.
Hmm.
I don't hear of any of my friends' children going travelling at 18 like they used to.
Yeah.
No, I don't. Do you?
My kids are younger, and I don't sort of currently have friends with kids of around that age. But well, actually, no, think about it. I do have a few, and I think in those cases, probably the parents wouldn't.
Yeah, they haven't gone travelling.
Go,
yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, not even. I mean, you think the communication would make stuff better, wouldn't
easier.
It?
Yeah,
because like,
exactly.
There were times when you go without speaking to your parents for days, weeks.
Absolutely.
Some
oh,
people.
God.
Yeah,
exactly. I was gone for 9 months in total, and I would have maybe like a monthly phone call or something like that. And I would write to them occasionally, and my mum would write back to me. And you know, if you're in one place long enough to actually get any mail, but otherwise, yeah, there was no communication. They just sort of turned you loose. And so looking back on that now as a parent, you know, I think that was great. That my obviously at the age of 18, you can do what you want, right? But you know, your parents are going to have some kind of influence over you. But I'm kind of surprised that they let me go. But again, a totally transformative experience. And I then went on to university feeling like I'd actually seen some of the world and feeling a lot more grown up than I felt when I left, you know, having, as I said, lived in Reading, you know, up until that point. Reading to Damascus, you know, quite the contrast.
That's the name of your book,
no,
Reading
absolutely.
To Damascus.
Yeah. And honestly, you weep for what happened to Syria. That country was so beautiful.
Apparently
and the people
so.
So hospitable and so welcoming. And to see it rent apart like that is utterly heartbreaking. And so many of the cities that suffered the worst are the places where we had the best time. Yeah. And we're given the warmest welcome, Aleppo, and it's awful. Just
and
awful.
In terms of the warmest welcome, you go back and stay at someone's flat. I mean, I don't think you just
honestly,
do that these
they
days,
had literally nothing. The Syrian state at the time, because it was so bankrupt, used to sell off its electricity to Iraq. And so there would be periods when there was just blackouts, across the city. So we'd be sitting there like in the dark with this family trying to think of what to sort of do or say. So, but
it's not like you've got a mobile phone.
No, exactly. No playing Tetris or whatever. So
were there any times that you were in, any sort of danger, do you think?
Thinking back over those 9 months, I can't think of a single occasion when I felt like we were. There were certainly moments of slight tension, possibly. Probably more in when I was sort of travelling through Israel and what was then kind of the occupied territories. You would just sort of feel there was a bit of an edge in the atmosphere. But generally, certainly nothing kind of directed specifically towards me or my pal George that I went travelling with. So, extraordinary, given the reputation that area has now, for danger and conflict. Just didn't feel it. Just didn't feel it at all.
So you went back to university transformed. Had you already decided at that point to follow in your father's footsteps? I realise you didn't become John Simpson or Ken Tady. or indeed, what's your dad's name?
Ted Oliver, he was called. So.
Ted Oliver.
I started writing when I was 15. I was obsessed with cycling. And so I started writing for the bike magazines back then. But this was in an era when everything was done by phone and fax. So they had no idea that I was 15 years old. They thought, basically, I bunked off school one day. My mum's going to be listening to this, but to go up to Ali Pali, where there was a big kind of cycling exhibition on, and the magazine that I was writing for had a stand there, so I thought, well, I'll go up and I'll introduce myself to them. And I'd written, I don't know, like 3 or 4 pieces for them, but yeah, like I said, everything had been done. I'd spoken to them on the phone, faxed them or posted them across the copy, and I turned up at the age of 15 in my school uniform, in my blazer, onto the stand that this cycling magazine had, and then the editor sort of looked at me, and I introduced myself and said, hey, I'm Ben Oliver, I've been writing these stories for you. And she said, but we thought you were an adult. And I'm like, well, is there any problem with the stories?
I will be one day.
Started with the cycling magazines. Then when I went travelling, obviously didn't do much. I actually wrote for Wanderlust, the travel magazine. Mm. I think in one of their very first issues, they took a piece on that trip to Syria, or my time in Syria. So I kind of sold out when I got back to university. Did a little bit of work with the tabloids in my first year at university, which paid very well, but was just morally bankrupt of me, I think. But then that's when the men's mags were really taking off, so FHM and Loaded Maxim.
Yeah.
And so I ended up writing for them, which was amazing. I mean, it was, God, what a time that was. Those magazines were, regardless of whatever you think about their politics and their attitudes.
Time.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of magazine publishing, there hasn't really been anything like it. FHM was selling 750,000 print copies a month. It was huge, And they had these great budgets, again, to travel and go overseas and do all these sort of mad stories.
And they were sponsoring loads of stuff. There was the Q Awards, which was from Q Magazine. That I was working on those at the time. They were just had so much money.
No, exactly.
Budgets were massive. Yeah.
And they really captured the zeitgeist. And even if that zeitgeist is not how we would choose to be now.
Yeah, when you look back, like Nuts, Loaded, Abby Titmus, what happened to that poor girl, that was just exploited, which she must have had something to do with it herself. But it was a crazy time.
It was bonkers, yeah. And they had big budgets. And sometimes, like decent writers and editors as well.
Did you start travelling with that then?
Yeah, again, there was lots of travel with that. So pretty much all the stories that I did for, I didn't work for Loaded. I had lots of friends who did. I worked for FHM and for Maxim. Mm. And so I did that all the way through university. And I would say my university degree suffered as a result.
Right. But it didn't really matter at that point.
Well, no, because you're kind of set
on
that.
You're writing for one of the top national magazines of the time. That's a pretty good little university job.
Yeah, definitely. And
So go on. Did you write about sex scandals and things? Give us the sleaziest story. What was the sleaziest story you've been involved in, Ben?
I probably wouldn't go into the proper kind of news sex scandals that I did for the tabloids.
You did do.
But certainly writing for the men's mags. I mean, I drove in a car race in Nevada where the prize was an hour. It was sponsored by a brothel, basically. And the prize was an hour in a hot tub with the hooker of your choice.
Oh, my God.
And
seriously.
So I came second. I made very, very sure that I came second. On the day that I was supposed to kind of sign up for all my courses for the final year of my university degree. And it was kind of a big deal. Like, you had to physically be there in person and sign on the line, like the university regulations. And the day that I was supposed to be doing that, I was on the set of a porn movie in Los Angeles doing a piece for FHM, and which they took as this big sort of 14, 16-page feature, because back then porn was kind of exotic. Like, you know, it wasn't that easy to get hold of.
It's everywhere now.
And so I'd managed to make contact with some porn producers, and me and the photographer went over there and spent a couple of days on these porn sets. So
oh my god, what was that like? I don't want to give the wrong impression of you, because you're a very nice man. But it was an interesting time. So what was it like being on porn sets? Where was it, in LA?
It was in LA. It was out in the San Fernando Valley. It was just oddly kind of clinical. Like, it's like watching a gallstone operation. You know, there was no kind of passion or enthusiasm there at all. And oh god, there's so many weird stories from that. One was having a chat with the husband of one of the porn stars while his wife was in flagrante delicto with some other star. And I said, well, why do you come along to these shoots? And he said, well, to make sure that, pardon my French, that no one fucks around with her. And I'm like, well, what's that? Like, you know.
We're talking literally or metaphorically, because it's literally happening right now.
I think it was just the metaphorical thing.
Right, yeah. Literal's fine. It's metaphorical fucking with them. It's a problem.
But it was a fascinating industry. I did that with a photographer called Larry Sultan, who was quite well known as a photographer. I mean, an artist, really, as well, actually, in LA. But he then ended up after that. That was kind of his first foray into porn. It was my only foray into porn. But he then ended up doing a whole, possibly like a series of books on LA's porn industry and exhibitions and all the rest of it. And Larry sadly died a few years ago. But the exhibitions were amazing. Like, his work was, you know, kind of documentary photography on that industry was just terrific and really well received. And this big sort of touring exhibition that came to London, actually. So,
Where did the cars? You're going from porn to cars. There is a connection. You and I were chatting earlier about how you used to go to car shows, and there'd be like, because I should explain actually that Ben and I are recording this in a car. What's the name of the car?
It's called a BYD.
It's an electric car, and we've come for this little sort of lunch that they're giving, because they're about to drive from London to Paris and do this sort of whole sort of launching a new car. Am I right?
So BYD is a Chinese car maker. It stands for Build Your Dreams, which is nice. You know, definitely one of the worst names that's ever been put in the back of a car, but they are amazing cars. It's a completely Chinese car maker. They're now, I think, like the third most valuable car maker in the world. They're building as many or more cars than Tesla, but they're coming to the UK now for the first time, which is why we should point out neither of us is sponsored by them. We've got no deal with BYD.
Maybe I'll go back and ask them for some money, but they are going to give us some lunch, and they've already given me a coffee. Yeah. But we're in the beautiful countryside out in Sussex, in Falmer, in a thatched barn. But anyway, what I was, it's probably irrelevant. Well, it may have painted a picture of words, I guess. We're in this beautiful area, and we've had a little drive down to Rottingdean in a little chat. Oh yeah, so we were talking about car shows and how they used to be like naked women dressed all over them. But I think what I wanted to go through next is from Falmer, you know, we are travelling. We've travelled all the way from Brighton. That's a good 5 miles, maybe. Yeah. So you're in porn briefly. One.
You make it sound like I was a performer. I was purely there as an observer. So,
well, you know, journalism isn't the best paid thing. There's OnlyFans accounts, you know, that my friend suggested I do one for my feet recently. So I don't know. You're just looking. I've got my training. You're seeing whether I have particularly sexual feet.
Hayward.
I don't think you have to have sexual feet. They'll, like, foot fetish people will pay for anything.
Yeah, foot fetish. It's really one that I don't get at all. But I don't know. Maybe like the older and gnarlier and more hobbit-like the feet, the more they like it.
I think so. Anyway, I digress. So you're in a one porn thing, working for FHM. This is in the 90s, early 2000s. And how did you fall into cars?
Cars, there was always like a big crossover between the men's mags and cars, because clearly there'd be like a lot of sort of motoring content in it. I'd always loved cars, and not being completely obsessed by them, but it was like, you know, an enthusiasm. And I started doing a bit of work for Top Gear magazine, and then writing some kind of car content for the motoring magazines. And then I was offered a couple of jobs, actually, one by Car Magazine, which is really lovely. Sort of a, you know, very long established, founded in 62 or 63, I think, Car Mag. And then Auto Car, which is a weekly car magazine, and I just thought it would be really nice, having been freelance since I was 15, basically, to actually go and work with some people and have a proper job. So I joined Autocar, and I was a test driver there, a road tester, alongside people like Chris Harris, who's now a presenter on Top Gear. And so did sort of like that kind of hardcore road testing for a while, but really wanted to get back to writing features, and so just ended up as kind of a car specialist. I left Autocar, and I've been a contributing editor on Car Magazine, the other one that offered me a job, since, God, like 2005 or something like that. And it's lovely, you know. Car Magazine is, it's famed for I sound a bit immodest, but like the quality of its writing, the quality of its photography, for kind of seeing cars in the round, you know, and you know, sort of doing travel pieces and talking about car culture and not just kind of focusing on the Metlin. It's been a real joy to be involved with that magazine. And I write for a bunch of other titles now, you know, sort of in the UK and around the world, newspapers and magazines and online, obviously, as well.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Yeah, that's kind of where the car thing came from. There was no plan, you know, like this isn't a career that has been planned in any way. I've lucked into it. But the amazing thing is that the car is, like, it's one of the defining influences of certainly the 20th century and to an extent the 21st as well, you know, along with, you know, industrialized warfare and the computer, you know, like the car, you know, defines the century. And so it impacts on absolutely everything. So as a writer about cars, you can cover pretty much every topic. Obviously the cars themselves and how they drive, but also travel. Clearly the environment is a massive issue, you know, sort of finance, economics, you know, manufacturing, how we structure our cities, all of these things you can write about when you specialize in cars. It doesn't feel like a narrow kind of specialism at all. And you know, for me, travel has been, you know, the thing that I've you know, kind of wanted to focus on the most, but I'm able to write about all of those.
Where
has
it taken you? Where have cars taken you? Do you like that?
God.
Literally. Yeah, where have they literally taken you? And where have they metaphorically taken you?
Well, like I said before, you know, I've been really fortunate in the sense that if there's been a part of the world that I've wanted to go to, I've generally been able to invent an excuse to go there in a car and sell that idea to a magazine. And so I've been down to Patagonia. I've taken a Bentley up 400 miles north of the Arctic Circle in the middle of winter, took a Land Rover into Lake Eyre, right in the middle of Australia, right in the Red Centre. Probably the single most bonkers thing was taking a completely standard Mini up to the highest place in the world where you can take a car, a place called the Kardang La Pass, up in the Indian Himalayas, right on the border, basically, between India and China, Tibet, and Pakistan.
How was that?
And it was completely insane. It was honestly one of the only times when I've sort of kind of pitched one of these ideas and put it together and genuinely thought, I'm not going to be able to pull this off. Like, this is too much. You know, we were driving through in monsoon at times. It was the right time of year to go, but we knew that there was going to be a risk from the floods. There were colossal floods in Himachal Pradesh as we were kind of going through it. I think 36 people were killed. The roads were literally being eaten out by the rivers underneath us as we were driving past. There was a moment when I was driving the Mini down one particular stretch of road, and it was an open top Mini, right? I had the roof down and I had the door open, because if the car started to tip into the water, I had to be able to bail out. We got stuck in a mountainside for 2 days because this kind of mud track that went around the mountain was the only way to get to the Kardang La Pass, which was what we were aiming for, this, you know, highest motorable road as they bill it. And yeah, there was a huge kind of rock slide that just completely destroyed the road. And so we were just stuck on this muddy mountainside for 2 days, behind a truck that had been hit by some rocks. And the Indian army, they managed to get a JCB up there, and they were debating whether to try and pull the truck out or just knock it down the mountainside in order to kind of clear this quite important supply route up to the part of India that we were trying to get into.
What did they go for?
They did pull it out in the end. Actually, the driver, obviously, it was his livelihood. He was begging them to kind of, you know, sort of not, you know, destroy his truck. So, yeah, that was bonkers. That took us 10 days and was properly hard, but spectacular. You know, I mean, and you're up at 18,000 feet. The oxygen level is really low. And it's a pretty dodgy part of the world as well. Bill Clinton said that if the Third World War starts, that'll be where it starts. And you kind of feel that tension when you're up there. But the landscapes were extraordinary. And yeah, we just decided to do it in a completely inappropriate car. And so Minis had just gone on sale in India, so that was kind of the excuse.
Oh, I see.
Do it.
Yeah, I was just wondering where the hook was for the story. As a journalist, I'm thinking, like, how did you pitch that?
I did have a four-wheel drive Toyota with us as well, but we only needed it twice to pull the Mini out. So, yeah, that was probably the single maddest one. But
what's been the longest one?
Longest in terms of time, probably, I don't know, maybe actually going to Lake Eyre in Australia. So that was, then the Mini were kind of similar. They were about sort of 10 days to actually get to the location. So yeah, I've not done any of the really long you know, kind of transcontinental trips, because, I mean, as a reporter, they don't necessarily make sense. You know, they're fun to do if you want to go and do a crazy road trip, but it's not the kind of thing that would necessarily make a great story, because, you know, obviously, like, time is money, and you've got to, you know, yeah. it is a job as well as fun. So,
what was the Alaskan one in the winter in a Bentley?
That was to Norway.
Oh, okay.
And so again,
what did
just
I think it was Alaska.
It was the Arctic Circle.
Oh, right, yeah.
That. So yeah, and yeah, there was an amazing Bentley which was launched. It was $250,000 back then. It would be probably $350,000 or $400,000 now. It was open top and rear wheel drive. Right, so it's the least suitable car to drive on snow and ice. But I just thought, like, what's the most spectacular thing you could look at through the open roof of this car? And so I thought the Northern Lights would probably be it. So I drove it from the UK, put it on the boat across to Norway, drove up through the Blood Highway, the Arctic Highway, up through Norway for 3 days, up to Tromsø to go and see the Northern Lights. And it was just bonkers. Like, you're driving at night in this fabulously expensive car on roads where you just cannot see the tarmac. Like, the snow is blowing so hard across the road, it looks like there's this sort of, like, white conveyor belt, you know, constantly kind of passing in front of you. You know, the car's obviously on snow tires, chains in the boot, and yeah, we managed to bring it back in one piece, and we saw the Northern Lights. I mean, that's the thing, it doesn't matter, you know, how much money you spend or how well you plan, the Northern Lights might not happen. You know, you can have a trip up there for 2 weeks and they might not show, but we were incredibly lucky and did get to see them. So
why is it called the Blood Highway?
Because of the physical trouble of making it, basically. So I think some might have been built with sort of forced kind of prisoner of war labour, and so just a huge number of people died building that road up through kind of the Arctic waste, and so it kind of acquired the nickname of the Blood Highway.
And then you are driving a convertible Bentley.
I know, exactly, yeah. Sitting there in air conditioned comfort, you know, in a big leather seat.
It was worth their sacrifice, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Worth their sacrifice.
They didn't die in vain.
No, so they'll be pleased. They will be, their families will be comforted,
yeah, exactly,
by your Bentley experience. So, what time of year was that?
It's supposedly the best time of year for the Northern Lights is kind of either side of Christmas, basically.
Yeah, but so kind of you, like, are in an open-top car. It's cold, right? There's snow.
Yes, so if it was snowing heavily, we'd put the roof up, but a lot of the time, if it wasn't snowing super heavily, we'd have the roof down, and we'd, me and my talking, and we'd just be sitting there in two jackets and two hats, and and the seat heaters on, even when it was down to sort of minus 15, minus 20. So, but yeah, supposedly the peak time for the Northern Lights is kind of October, November, and then again February, March. And so that trip, I think we did, yeah, sort of end of February, beginning of March. So it was properly cold. And it feels quite high consequence, even though you're in Norway, it's a very civilized country, you're never really that far away from help. But still, like, you know, when you're driving at night in those kind of conditions, and in heavy sort of blizzard conditions, it's, you know, it's,
I mean, driving is hazardous, you know, it has it. I don't know what the stats are, but obviously it's very safe in many ways. But you know, it's hazardous driving down the road here, you know, close to your house, isn't it?
And I think that's kind of what makes a good magazine travel feature is a degree of jeopardy. So, you know, and I think sometimes a lot of people have a bit of a misconception about motoring journalism. You know, they think it's all about just writing about the cars, how they drive, how much they cost, you know, consumer issues, and all that's really valid and really important. But for me, the joy of doing what I do has always been the fact that you've been able to go off and make these trips, you know, and have those experiences, and that's what kind of cars allow you to do. You know, I was having this conversation with a friend the other day. He said, you know, we have to, you know, every time you sort of explain that you either you're a motoring journalist or you work with cars, or even if you just like cars, you sort of feel obliged to say, if you're at a dinner party or whatever, oh, you know, but, like, I'm not like Jeremy Clarkson. You know, I'm not, you know, I'm not a slightly kind of gammony, slightly Brexity, you know, sort of grumpy man in late middle age. You know, there are some of us who are into cars based on what they allow you to do, you know, and where they can take it, you know. I'm slightly concerned that if people listen to this podcast, they'll sort of read the description and assume that I'm some kind of, like, pound shop Jeremy Clarkson, basically, you know.
That's the title. Whereas, yeah. No, I've just given me the title.
Ben Oliver, the pound shop Jeremy
Clarkson.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Well, I'm like the Simon Calder that just knows sod all compared to him.
I nearly knocked Simon Calder off his bike.
Did you?
Yeah, well, I think he sort of rode into me. No, I was in a really, really low...
Because if you do, I'd get a lot more work.
Oh, no. Unfortunately, this was years ago. So, I was driving a Caterham, which is this incredible Caterham Super 7, this super low little thing based on, like, an old sort of racing Lotus from the 1950s. And I think he just didn't see me. And I was driving it round East End of London, somewhere like Shoreditch.
And he sort of
turned into me on his bike. And I thought, fuck, he's about to hit the car. And then I looked up and it was TV Simon Calder.
Really? So, yeah. Okay, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I should
Next
have just swerved
and taken off. Exactly. On his bike.
Yeah, but then there'd be video evidence. So I'd be,
yeah, no, you're right. You'd be everything. So, yeah. Did you tell me you've been to Korea? Which one?
I have been to both.
You have? Amazing.
So it was the car industry that took me to South Korea. And we did a story, again, weirdly in a mini, actually, where we sort of drove it as far towards the demilitarized zone as you could. And then went into the demilitarized zone and had that sort of tour of the DMZ and went into kind of the blue sheds that kind of straddled the border between North and South Korea. But then a few years later, I managed to get into North Korea, not very strictly not as a journalist, but purely as a private individual, because I was just desperate to go, absolutely desperate to go. There was no country I wanted to go to more. I just thought that it's so unique, this whole nation personality cult. Like, how often does that arise? And also, frankly, how long could it last? And I thought, look, sooner or later, that regime is going to go pop, you know, and sadly it hasn't gone pop yet. But I wanted to just go and witness it and experience it while I could, you know. And so I was working in China anyway. I was doing a story there. For one of the car magazines, but then purely in a personal capacity, because I was in Beijing anyway, I was able to arrange with some people to, you know, get my visa and get my Foreign Office, North Korean Foreign Office guides and get the whole thing set up, and went in just for sort of 4 full days, basically. And that was honestly one of the single most extraordinary travel experiences I've ever had. I would feel a bit reluctant talking about it in too much detail, because even though it was a few years ago...
You feel like you're being watched?
Well, they will listen to your podcast, like, you know, I'm sure the North Korean Foreign Ministry will listen to
the
Big Travel Podcast.
They're big fans.
But the fact is, obviously, I am a journalist. I had to tell a bit of a fib on my application form. I went in with absolutely no intention of reporting on it, and I never have, but I'm just aware that the people who helped me get in there have a relationship with the North Koreans. And if my foreign ministry guides didn't pick up on the fact that I'm a journalist, that might cause a problem for them. But it was
a lot of countries, like, I don't know if generally people listening to the podcast will know this, but a lot of countries, when I travel somewhere, I don't say I'm a journalist. No. I don't know, I'm a writer or something, or I don't know. Because you obviously with the, you know, it's a completely different situation over there. But even like going into the States, you know, it's Israel, I've been to, you know, you just don't say it. No. Just causes too many problems.
Exactly.
It just
creates that extra layer of
complexity. Exactly.
The only danger is if they then realise that you are going there for the purposes of reporting and you haven't got the right visa, you haven't got an I visa for the
so
US.
Were you reporting?
No, I absolutely didn't. So
what was it like? Talk about it from a holiday experience then, not as a journalist.
Yeah, from a sort of a general perspective, it was, I mean, there's nowhere else like it on earth. You know, it's, God, where do you start? Like, there's so many, probably the weirdest experiences I wouldn't relate, because they could still get people there in trouble. But I think you're aware when you're there that, you know, people are raised in North Korea from sort of nursery school age to sing, you know, Shoot the Yankee Bastard as like a nursery rhyme or a nursery song or whatever. And because people live in, very often in small villages, their movement is controlled. You know, you don't leave the village unless you've got a specific reason to. When those people from those villages come into Pyongyang, into the capital, to do like a cultural tour, which they do every so often, to, you know, sort of pay tribute to all the various monuments to the kings, if they see you as a Westerner in Pyongyang, you might well be the first Westerner they've ever seen. And they've been absolutely raised to hate you, you know. And I think some of the value for me in that trip was seeing people like that, and seeing kind of like the apprehension and the fear or the worry or the confusion on their face when they see you, and just smiling at them, you know, or giving them a little wave, and just seeing that starting to break down very slightly. Also, frankly, you know, seeing people seemingly genuinely burst into tears as soon as they saw these great monuments to the Kims, and trying to figure out, do they really feel that love and that loyalty to that family, or are they just doing it because they're terrified about what will happen to them otherwise? So, and also, frankly, the level of bullshit as well. Like, they took me to the North Korean, the Pyongyang film studios, which were completely deserted. Right, there's nobody there, and I said, hey, where is everyone? And they said, oh, they're all out in location. And I'm like, what, all of them? And they just believe this stuff, and they'll repeat it. So, but it was bonkers. Honestly, there's so many stories I could tell from that. Some which, you know, might seem a bit excessive, but I'd worry even now about you know,
sort of getting
people
into trouble.
Protect
the people who took you in there.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, then I was able to kind of stand. Like, probably not many people have done this. You know, I'd sort of stood on the South Korean side of the demilitarized zone. I was able to do the same thing on the North Korean side. In order to get there, I had to sort of, you know, wait 2 years and go back via London. But there's probably not many people who sort of stood either side of that line, because so few people get into North Korea. So, odd, weirdest thing I've ever done. But
what else stands out in your travels? I'm aware that we've got to go to... First of all, we've got to go to lunch in a minute with the... with the car people, and then I've got to go live on the BBC News channel somewhere
you
outside
do,
of here.
Yeah, because you're a proper celebrity.
Oh, yeah,
so
no,
I'm getting massive imposter syndrome here.
No,
because you look back at, like, the people you've had. You've had Warwick Davis, who was in Star Wars. You know, you've had, like, Minnie Driver.
Yeah.
And now you've got the Pound Shop Jeremy Clarkson.
Yeah, so it's, Simon Calder. Yeah, so. Exactly. No, when I'm listening to all the places you've travelling, I think you've been to, like, far more places than I have, and I'm a travel expert.
Yeah, but then you've got to have the reason to go there. And the great thing is, like I said, the car industry just enables you to go there. North Korea was different.
I need to maybe drive my cars.
Yeah, definitely. Well, listen, in the EV era, you know, we're sitting in an EV now, we can absolutely still do road trips. You know, it's still going to be possible. But it'll just be properly environmentally friendly. You know, I do a little road trip every year with my kids from the South Coast, where we live, up to the northwest coast of Ireland, where a bunch of my family live. And you can do that fully electrically now. So even with, you know, me, my partner, dog, two kids, bikes on the roof, all the rest of it, it is possible. So
I had I was in Sweden and Denmark 2 weeks ago seeing my brother. My brother was playing in this big festival. He's a musician, and he was playing this rock band with Mike Tramp and the Songs of White Lion. They used to be very big in the 80s, and Mike is very well known still in Denmark. And anyway, they're playing in this Sweden rock festival, so I flew over and met him there, got the train up to Sweden rock. It was about 2 hours on the train from Copenhagen, and then I was going to drive back with the band, which I did. But the band, somebody had rented them an EV, and they've never had one before, and they all went along to the festival, parked the car, went and did the gig. Then after the gig, we all got drunk backstage and had a great time, and then we came back out to the car, and nobody had charged the car. So we spent about 4 hours getting back from Sweden. We got back at 4 o'clock in the morning, stopping at petrol stations where they had, you know, charging, electric chargers, you know, doing like 20 minutes here, then 20, driving another bit, do 20 minutes there. And they were like, oh, the stupid people shouldn't have rented us an EV. I was like, no, you should have got someone to go and park it and
charge it while
charge it in. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, there is it's quite funny, though.
The Scandinavians are amazing. They are one of the biggest and earliest adopters of electric vehicles, and their charging network is okay. I think we sort of obsess a little bit too much, I think, about the state of the public charging network that you're using to get back, because we're used to having petrol stations always within easy reach, you know, used to being able to kind of drive into one of those, fill up, and within kind of 5 minutes, you know, you're gone. And yes, the public charging network in the UK could be an awful lot better, you know. And when I do those you know, big road trips in the electric vehicle in the UK, because our regular family car is an EV, it can be a pain sometimes. But the point is, it's so rare. There are so few days when you're actually using more than the range of your car. The vast majority of days, 360 days a year, say, you will wake up with a full battery in your car. You won't get anywhere near, you know, using up all that charge in your daily driving. And you come back home and you might not even bother plugging it in that night, because you know you're not going to use it all the next day. So if it's a bit inconvenient on, you know, the 5 days, for argument's sake, when you're doing big mileages, doing more than 300 miles in a day, yeah, it's a pain in the bum, but you kind of weigh that up against the massive convenience and the lower cost and the lower emissions, obviously, that you have on all of those other days. So
you're a fan, basically.
Oh, a massive fan, our fourth family electric car is going to arrive in September, and we've had three so far, and I wouldn't go back to petrol for daily driving. So on long trips it can still be a pain, but and the charging network really needs to improve, but it will improve. You know, we've got to give it time.
Where have I missed in terms of your travels, because you've had so many?
God, I don't know. I don't know. North Korea definitely seems like the biggest one.
Yeah, yeah.
Kashmir, Kardong La, it was called. That pass was definitely the maddest and most dangerous and highest one. I don't know. For me now, it's, I think the joy really is in taking my kids places, and probably the.
I really
the,
want to take my kids more places. So. Yeah, well, I don't get to because I can't really afford it. I really want to. Yeah. No. But need to do more family travel features.
Yeah. And I kind of wonder at what age they really start to appreciate the place where you are. You know, mine are 8 and 10 now. I think what they really love, for me anyway, about travel is just the time that you spend together. You know, the fact that you know, there's no distractions. We're you know, we're just out together. We're doing stuff. But also, what they love is a road trip. You know, it sounds like child cruelty when I tell people that I take my kids on a 2-day road trip from where we live in Sussex and up to Donegal, like literally diagonally across the British Isles. And when we get up there, of course, there's loads of fun. The family are all up there. There's amazing beaches in Donegal. It's just stunning. I love that place. But honestly, what my kids love most is the road trip. There's very little kind of screen time. They just love that time in the car, listening to music, sort of playing dumb word games. And so for the trip that we're going to do this summer, I'm going to actually extend the road trip bit and do slightly fewer miles each day, but just take a more kind of circuitous route up to Donegal. We're going to go by Snowdon, probably. We're going to spend a little bit of time. Then we'll get the boat from Holyhead across to Dublin, spend a bit of time in Dublin, maybe go to Newgrange, which is an old sort of Stone Age site in Ireland, and from there kind of drive up to Donegal and just focus on that, you know. And I feel like, because I'm a motoring journalist, am I inflicting the road trip on my kids? But genuinely,
maybe
that's
it,
a bit,
yeah.
And maybe they pick up on your enthusiasm as well. So
all my childhood holidays before we moved to Spain, when I was seven, they were all camping in the south of France with my parents, who had camper vans. I told you that they
13
had
camper 13 vans. That was amazing.
Camper
vans. Not at the same time.
Not at the same time, no, but my dad worked at Vauxhall's and he had skills and contacts and he used to buy an empty van. They were all these like lovely...
Oh, so he did the conversions himself?
No, he didn't. He'd get someone else to do it, but he got a good deal.
Yeah.
And they were all like beautiful VW camper vans, you know, that were actually being given away quite readily at that point. Nobody wanted them. And, my parents were starting in the 60s, but the 60s, 70s and early 80s.
Yeah.
And then drive down to the south of France. And I have amazing memories of those camping trips. I do.
Yeah.
I've got to ask you my last question, because we've got to go and have lunch and then I've got to go live on the BBC News Channel. I'm like a proper journalist.
A real one. Not one of these Ponzi motoring journalists.
Obviously,
a real one.
I don't know
one,
what I'm talking about. Where's Simon Calder when you need him? So I'm going to ask you my last question, which is always about music. And I think you're a music fan, aren't you?
I am, yeah.
Because I very much think that music, and oh my God, music and driving so go hand in hand as far as I'm concerned. If you had to choose one song that reminds you of a memorable time and place of travel, what is that song? And what road trip are you on?
Doesn't
have to be a road trip. I'm just assuming you were.
I thought that was going to be really difficult, actually, and you're going to put me on the spot, but it's pretty easy, to be honest. When I was on that big road trip in the Mini up to Car d'Angla, this sort of highest motorable road in the world, getting up to that final pass at 18,000 feet wasn't easy, but it wasn't that dramatic. The main difficulty was getting into Zanskar and Ladakh, which is kind of the province, you know, from which this pass kind of rises, because you have to go through a pass called Rotangla, which is known as the place of death, basically. and that's where the big rock slide was, and we kind of got stuck for 2 days. Anyway, once we got through that, we were then officially in Kashmir. And I, hopefully, fairly broad musical taste, but I'd really do love Led Zeppelin. I had saved, I deliberately not listened to Kashmir for like the 7 days or whatever it had taken us to get from Delhi to that point. But as I crossed the border into Kashmir, I put on Kashmir and I might have had a little bit of a cry. So it was the scenery up there, it looks like the cover of a prog rock album. It's bonkers, like the colours of the mountains, purples and blues, and you're in this very sort of high, cold desert environment, which I hadn't really been in before, and the whole thing was so extraordinary. And to actually be in Kashmir, to have got through it, to have not died on that mountain place, and to then have, you know, Page and Plant playing that was a moment.
I can totally feel that because I love the song, I love Led Zeppelin, I love Ben, thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Big Travel Podcast. Remember, subscribe on whatever app you're using, and you can get every single episode downloaded into your little handy phone device totally for free.